Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good middle of the night, wherever you are. Welcome to DevelopPod episode 29, where we continue with series on interviews with thought leaders and influencers in ELT. Earlier this year, as part of our annual TDC Scholarship Awards, we put out a competition for people to win free iATEFLA memberships. The application for this included nominating someone in the ELT industry and explaining how that person had influenced their teaching and their career. They also had to include questions they would love to ask that person if they ever had the chance to meet them. Here for you now is our fifth interview, where we connect Oleg with Jim Scrivener. Now, before we get to Oleg's questions and Jim's answers, let me first introduce you to Jim Scrivener. Jim has had a very long career in ELT, and many of you will know him by his excellent teacher resource books, Learning Teaching, Teaching Grammar, as well as through the coursebook series Straightforward. Jim has worked in many ELT jobs in different countries, including Kenya, the USSR, and Hungary. He's been head of teacher training for IH Hastings, which is where I actually first met him, back in 1993, I think, as well as director of education for IH Budapest, and is currently head of teacher development for Bell International, which is based in Kent. Now, interestingly, Oleg's question for Jim is in relation to the work that he has done with Adrian Underhill and their Demand High concepts. So let's hear Oleg's burning question.
Hello, my name is Oleg, and I work as an English teacher and DOS at a typical language school here in St. Petersburg, Russia. I've been teaching English for quite a while, for more than 26 years, and I feel I have, which allowed me to gain quite a lot of experience. Anyway, thank you for giving me the opportunity to ask Jim directly. Hello, Jim. My question regards the Demand High approach which you and Adrian Underhill developed, and more specifically, the question concerns the component of this approach, which is called learning to see learning. It's the part of the Demand High which recommends that teachers give a series of mini one-to-one lessons within the whole group lesson in an attempt to upgrade each individual student's language. I personally wholeheartedly agree with this, and in my experience, I find this tactic quite effective. But what quite often happens in my classroom, say when I'm working one-to-one with a student, and especially if we are working on improving his or her pronunciation, but the student can't articulate the target sound correctly first time, and given that everybody else in class is watching him and probably waiting for him to get it right, then this student will often start feeling embarrassed, and for an obvious reason, because the student would be under pressure. To reduce this pressure, what I do is I often start looking away at the wall, and I feel it helps to a certain extent. But anyway, again, given that you recommend involving everybody when giving this mini one-to-one lesson, you say that everybody else in the class should be involved and should be party to this process. My question for you is, have you ever experienced the same problem which I have just explained? And or have you ever witnessed this kind of scenario during your observations? And what would you recommend doing to solve this problem? Thank you.
So thank you so much for joining us today in our virtual classroom, Jim. Welcome.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Happily, one of our winners, Oleg, has always been inspired by the work that you've done, and in particular, the work that you've done with Adrian Underhill in your focus on demand high. So before we look specifically at Oleg's question, can you give us a brief overview of what demand high is and maybe what the inspiration was behind it?
Yeah, sure. The inspiration was, well, it was a lot of tea, really. Adrian and I used to meet regularly with no particular aim in mind, just to sit down and talk through our lives and review, reflect on where we got to. It was a sort of professional chat, if there's such a thing. Mm-hmm. And while we were doing this, I started the habit of taking notes of what we were saying. And a number of topics came up while we were talking, looking back over the things we'd seen in our teaching careers, in our training careers. And we realized that we both had a very similar observation, that we'd seen professionally, we'd observed lots and lots of lessons as trainers or examiners or assessors or just colleagues going in to watch other teachers in our schools working. Mm-hmm. And we realized that we saw a lot of lessons where there was a lot of fun, a lot of happiness, lots of excitement, teachers running activities that seemed very interesting and enjoyable, everyone having a good time. But the question that kept bugging us was, is this really leading to tangible learning? Have we got ourselves into a mode where ELT is an awful lot of fun activity, where tasks are done and managed successfully, but where that really has become almost the teacher's main job, just to make sure that those tasks happen and keep moving. We all seem to have become very competent at operating course book activities, tasks, but there was very, very little what we considered to be challenge on the language that was being learnt. The challenge was coming in different areas. It was around things like, can I win the game? Can I finish the exercise before somebody else? Can I do 10 answers? Can I find 12 words? All that sort of thing. But whether people were actually getting better seemed to be quite hard to pin down. And we felt we'd seen lots of really good teachers who had somehow bought into this idea that the communicative approach is doing stuff, it's operating activities. But the question of where the learning happens seemed to be getting a bit lost. And we had a feeling that learners were capable of more than they were being asked to do.
So do you mean then that you felt that teachers weren't doing enough clarification or error correction or...
I think those things come into it, but it's a feeling that we saw people covering material rather than actually questioning how learning happens. Mm. And the idea that you can actually intervene to help somebody get better on the spot seems to be an idea that's almost dropped out of language teaching. Now, if you go back a long time to sort of the boring old past that everybody sees, it where people did drills and people did exercises, the teachers were very focused on helping in some way, as in whatever way, good or bad, that they thought, students to get better. Mm. But that sort of focus does seem to have disappeared. We're not advocating a return to that past. What we're saying is, can we find a way to really start focusing on, is anybody actually learning anything here? How can I make that learning happen more? Mm. We came to start calling it not teacher-centered, not learner-centered, but learning-centered. Can we actually focus on how learning happens? Can we learn a bit more about how learning happens in the class? Yeah. One of the things that came to be a key focus was this idea that it's okay to teach, because we felt a lot of teachers felt that they'd been told by their training courses to back off, to step back, to just let the learners get on with it and do it, that lots of fluency is great, which is fine, you know, nothing against fluency, but you can't rely on simply giving people tasks, letting them do it, giving one or two little corrections at the end, and then somehow magically hoping that out of this, the learning will happen. It does sometimes, you know, incidentally, you get lots of learning just by doing stuff. But we felt that there was a case for the teacher to intervene and push a little bit more, to consciously try. If you hear a sentence that a student says, don't just nod and say, okay, interesting, when you know that it could be better. Can you help that student to make that one sentence very slightly better? And then, you know, 2 minutes later, another student, something else. Can you help them to get one step better? This idea of constant, conscious upgrade. So that at the end of the lesson, a student will go out saying, well, I didn't learn much, maybe, but I am slightly better. I know I'm better. Rather than I've done 10 fun activities or I've run around, I've won the game. I am actually sure that I'm slightly better at English than I was when I came in.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay. And so would you say then that this approach demands different strategies or techniques from the teacher, or a different focus on what they already know how to do, or something kind of in between, or something that they, is it a confidence issue? Is it a strategies issue? What do you think is happening?
I think we were very definitely not saying that it's a new methodology. You don't have to change your methodology. One of the things we're very keen on saying is, however you teach, whatever you do, you know, even whether it's grammar translation or dogme or whatever it is that you do, is there a way of thinking a little bit more, is learning actually happening or am I just entertaining them? Mm-hmm. Are we doing this just for the fun of it, or is there some visible learning going on? Mm-hmm. And it is partly a confidence issue, because a lot of teachers nowadays don't feel comfortable with stopping a student and saying, hang on a minute, let's just hear that sentence again. Do you think you can make that better? Can you find a way to say that better? Can anybody else give some ideas? This isn't currently a strategy that many teachers use, mm-hmm. or they don't feel very confident about using it, because by and large, we've been trained over the last 20 years to be very encouraging, and whatever a student says, to say, well done, that's very good. And I think one of the key confidence issues is learning to say, no, that's not quite there yet, or no, that's not a good sentence, or no, you didn't express your meaning clearly, or no, the pronunciation could be better, in a way that is encouraging and actually helps them to improve. Mm-hmm. How can you say no sometimes? I think I would say is a key confidence skill.
Yes, I completely agree. I've definitely seen that in my experience as a teacher trainer as well, where even colleagues as well, this idea of not wanting to hurt students' feelings. There seems to be this very softly approach, whereas I find that I agree. I have seen it very effectively done, where there's clear boundaries that teacher sets and clear indications of what's effective, what's not effective, what's correct, what's not correct. And I find that that can actually create even more trust in the classroom and encourage students and motivate them even more, because the feedback that they get from their teacher isn't vague. It's actually quite clear
and
they can see where they're trying to go.
Students can see through the praise, the constant praise. They know it means nothing. Whatever they say, the teacher says, good, well done. And it just becomes a wall of noise very, very quickly, because it doesn't mean anything. But if every time a student says something, the teacher listens and instead of praises, actually consciously withholds the praise, instead of praising, gives a little bit of feedback, which could be that was a very well-formed sentence. You know, actually some information, that was a very well-formed sentence. Or that I didn't understand the third word. I think maybe the stress was in the wrong place. Do you want to try and say it again? Mm-hmm. Giving some information that helps the student to take a small step forward, that's where the learning happens. That's where the improvement happens. And I mean, Adrian and I, we strongly believe that's what we as language teachers should be doing. Nice. And yet what we see in many, many classrooms is teachers fearful of doing that. And I think it's surprising that somehow we've got to this position where many teachers are scared of saying no, of giving feedback, and they feel that it's part of their duty to praise constantly.
Yeah, I agree. Excellent. Okay. Now, one of the points that Oleg wants to touch on is this idea of the...
Hello, Oleg.
You know, I think he really wishes that he was here to go, hey, Jim. So his question is, how can he help overcome this challenge?
Just the abbreviation there. This is one of these rather lovely names we've been trying to give to things. 3XP stands for 3 times practice. And the basic idea is that one of the things we felt we'd seen teachers do was speed page through course books, basically turning the pages. You do an exercise, and very often it's just getting through the exercise. Have you done the questions? You finished all 9 of them? Good, let's check the answers. 1, 2, yeah, yeah, good, 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 moving on. And we felt that although, you know, sometimes exercises can be boring or dull, but simply racing through them wasn't actually achieving anything. The first time you do an exercise, there's almost no learning that comes out of it. Either you know the answers and you get them right, or you don't know them and you hear the answers at the end, or you cheat by borrowing them from somebody else. But there's actually almost no learning happening there. Mm. So the 3XP, 3 times practice idea is simply, why don't you do an exercise more than once? Now, that's not a suggestion for a way to be boring in the classroom. Well, the idea is, can you go back into the same material, the same exercise, as if you're sort of mining it for a little bit extra value? So the first time you do the exercise in the normal way, maybe they do it individually or they do it in pairs or whatever, and maybe you check the answers with them or whatever it is you like to do to check answers. But instead of rushing on to do the next thing straight away, you ask them to go back, not to do the same exercise exactly the same again, but to do it a little bit deeper. So, for example, you might say, okay, now cover up the question words and look at your answers. Can you remember the questions? Mm. Or could you think of a way to change the questions so that you could make a different answer? Well, there's lots of ideas for variations on this, but just to use essentially the same material with a slight twist. Mm-hmm. But so they go back in and they keep they get further practice with the same material. And then you go in a third time and you try and make it a bit more personal or a bit more communicative. So this may come down to memorizing the whole thing in some way, or to read it aloud, or to do it as a role play or something. Mm-hmm. It's not a very, you know, it's not a brand new idea, not anything astonishingly original, but just the idea that rather than racing through stuff, you go back in to see if you can actually get the learning from it. And my experience of doing this is, it's amazing what they've got by the third time they do the same material in slightly different ways. They can actually go out of the classroom with the 8 sentences in their head, really, mm-hmm. able to use them to speak to other people, to do something with them. Whereas the first time they go through, they won't remember a single thing, probably. They'll hardly remember a word or the grammar item or whatever it is that they were setting out to do.
No. So in the situation, yeah, it sounds like Oleg is saying that there's, I don't know, maybe a certain type of student or population of student that can actually find this a bit frustrating. Have you experienced that as well, where there's a certain element that find it frustrating? Or do you think that perhaps the question
first
is...
First of all, just his question, go into the wording of his question. He said, mm-hmm. In order to increase the amount of learning, the enforced repetition within the 3XP technique prescribed by demand time. I'd just like to pick out those two words in his question, enforced and prescribed. There's really nothing enforced or prescribed about this. All we're trying to do is suggest some ideas that will perhaps work in your class. And if your students or you feel that there's something enforced or prescribed in this, then you really maybe shouldn't be doing it at all, because the idea of 3XP is just, might it be fun to try an exercise a second time or a third time? You know, if you start doing it as a ritual, I've got to do this 3 times, then it's going to be hell, probably. Nobody can enjoy it. And we certainly wouldn't suggest doing every exercise you do 3 times. You know, you maybe do 7 exercises as normal, but the 8th one you say, hey, look, now you've done it, go back in, and this time cover up this and see if you can do this, or change all the people words to names of people you know. Just, you know, very, very simple, small things. Mm-hmm. Now, that's just the first point. The second thing is, he's suggesting that, he says, the struggle to reproduce the music of the language. Well, of course, sounding like a competent speaker of the language is very hard for every student. And I think it's one thing that we can work on successfully in class. But if your students find it hard, and it's really getting them down or getting them frustrated, then don't push it too far, would be my suggestion. It's, you know, as simple as that. But don't under push it, because there is learning in the difficulty. The difficulty is actually where we hit our the blocks in our learning. Mm-hmm. And I think that's precisely where, you know, lots of teachers over the years give up. When something becomes difficult, they say, okay, let's do something that's not too difficult. Let's give you something easy. But the easy thing is something you can do already, so what's the point of doing it? So you've got to find your own personal balance. What is something you can push them on that is just one small step ahead of where they are? Don't try and get them to say a perfect sentence, perhaps. You know, they don't need to get everything right. They don't need to sound like, you know, a member of the House of Lords when they're saying a sentence. To get them pronouncing one word with better stress, mm-hmm. and that's already a step forward. Mm-hmm. Get them with the intonation at the end of the sentence, maybe not the whole sentence, just the end. Can they get it going down rather than up, or whatever it is they're having problems with? And then don't praise them, but just point out, hey, look, that's very interesting. That sounds so much better now.
Yes.
You've actually got the sound going down rather than up. Tell them what they've done. Point out that it's better. Mm-hmm. And they'll start to feel good. Okay, I can achieve this. I think don't try and correct everything in a sentence or improve everything at once. Mm-hmm. And get away. Maybe one of the interesting things that we've been pushing a bit with Demand High is that correction is rather an unhappy concept generally. Don't worry too much about correction. Think of this idea, this word upgrade. Can you make their sentence one step better, slightly better? It won't necessarily be perfect. It won't all be right. Work on the endings of the grammar, or work on the word stress, or work on whether they actually get their meaning across. One small step, and get them to do that better than they did before. And that's enough. That's fine. So it sounds like Oleg is maybe pushing a little bit towards perfection. I don't think his students need to. I think if they're finding it frustrating, if they're finding they get down with it, then if it's a challenge they can't overcome, then maybe that's the wrong challenge. What is the next step for that particular student, for that one?
Excellent. Well, I think there's two takeaways for me from what you've just said. First of all, again, I think it's that idea of a measured approach to our teaching, where we do get informed by new frameworks, new ideas, new perspectives. But it is always still important to see ourselves in the center of that, and that we are trying to work with the students who are in front of us within that context, as opposed to fully taking on board one new idea and then implementing it in a very prescriptive kind of manner. So I think there's that measured approach to things. And I think also, I really love what you've just said about upgrading. So upgrading, not correction, because I think you're right. And I do think that, that's a really, really, really important point to focus on, that I wonder if maybe that's perhaps the heart of the hesitancy or the discomfort that a lot of teachers can feel about doing error correction, is because there seems to be this this idea in the room that we're heading for perfection.
Yes.
And that can create anxiety in everybody in the room, because, I mean, we all know that it's not going to happen. We don't even really need perfection. But I wonder if more teachers really kind of considered and took on that perspective of upgrading as opposed to correction towards perfection, it gives them more of that confidence and permission to be in that role of guide and worker with the language, as opposed to coming down, feeling like they're coming down with the error correction stick, I suppose. So for me, that whole concept of upgrading is excellent. Yeah, I love that.
There's one other very powerful result if you start thinking about upgrading rather than correction, and that's that you can start to get rid of this problem that there are some strong students in your class and some weak students, and this is terribly visible. Because what very often happens in many classes is the teacher asks a question, the strong students put up their hands and start shouting, and they say the answer. And the teacher sort of has to say, yeah, okay, that's right, good. or they ask the weak student, and the strong students are going, he hasn't got it right, and then they stumble over the answer. Whereas if you take the attitude that whatever anybody really says in class, whether they're a weak student or a strong student, I'm going to try and give them an upgrade. Rather than saying, good, brilliant, fantastic, you're brilliant, or that's a terrible answer, you don't do any of that. You don't do the praise and you don't do the telling off. Whatever somebody says, you're going to offer them an upgrade. And that could be true. You know, even if you've got a native speaker in your class, you can still, whatever the student says, process it in your head, scan the sentence or the sentences they said, and see if you can offer some feedback rather than a praise comment. Can you say something to them like something that they could do to make it better? With the struggling students, that may well be the grammar or the wrong word or a basic pronunciation problem. But with the higher level students, you know, once you've got all the words in the right order, you still don't praise them. You say, okay, I didn't quite believe what you said, though. Could you say it in a way that makes it sound more persuasive to me? Mm-hmm. Something like that. So you give them feedback about, you know, beyond the grammar, beyond the word order and the lexis, into how they're getting their message across, whether it's convincing, whether it's persuasive or believable, whether they seem to be inhabiting their message. There's the whole range of feedback you can give, which means whatever anybody says, nobody's ever getting being told, you're the fantastic one and you're the dreadful one in the class. And that actually starts to change rooms, because everyone starts to be more ready to say something. Everybody has something to learn. Everyone goes away with a takeaway at the end.
It's funny. In my head, I'm picturing, you know, people who listen to this interview and you know, who really kind of take on board this idea of upgrade. I wonder if there's going to be a new catchphrase in the classroom. You know, we always say, okay, work with your partner, check in pairs. And then it's going to be, can I offer you an upgrade? Because everybody loves an upgrade.
Yeah, I mean, it's a positive thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's very positive.
It's not saying you got it wrong, which, you know, most of us sort of take a step back and feel a bit miserable when somebody says you got it wrong. Would you like an upgrade? I like that, Just going back to Oleg's question, it's very important that all these ideas we're suggesting that they're done playfully, that this isn't some horrible, you know, hit you over the head drill kind of thing. If they can't be done in a spirit of exploring together and playing around with the language and having fun, and I'm going to try this out and see if it works. Oops, it doesn't work. Let me try saying that sentence in a different way. It's part of the joy of language, and somehow we've lost that a little bit in many classrooms. Can we get this sense of we're all experimenting with the language? Even native speakers are experimenting with the language to see what's possible, what's not possible. And you're doing it and I'm doing it, and let's just try this out together.
I totally agree. And I think I love that idea of, you know, that openness, that, you know, approaching these things with openness, curiosity, playfulness, the nature of the beauty of experimentation in your classroom as well. And I think that just opens everybody up to it as well. So I think that's a really good point. I'm really glad that you brought that in. Well, thank you again so much for joining us in our virtual studio this morning, Jim. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you. And I can only imagine that Oleg out there, when he hears the interview, is going to be thrilled that you were able to answer his question with such clarity, depth, insight, and I think some really, really good takeaway points for everybody. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us today. We here at DevelopPod hope you found this episode interesting and inspiring. Please keep an eye and an ear out for our next episode as we continue with connecting our membership winners to the folks they most wanted to question. Wishing you health, prosperity, and happiness from all of our DevelopPod team.